Let us start with an image. October 29th, 1493. The City of London has turned out in force to see a royal procession. It's not a coronation, but it follows the same route taken by coronations. From out of the Tower of London comes a small procession, and at its centre is a three-year-old boy. He sits upon a small horse, alone, precariously riding it, calmly focused on the task before him. And around him, the Londoners cheer and call out in utter astonishment at this young boy and his skill at doing this. That boy is Henry, the second son and third child of King Henry VII, who is right now on his way to Westminster. He will ride the traditional coronation route taken by royals to be invested with title, leaving the Tower, processing along Cheapside, and then down along Fleet Street, then down to Westminster itself, where tomorrow will be more formal celebrations and rituals. But right here and right now, this young boy rides through London, and all are amazed. In time, this boy will, of course, become the wonder of his age, King Henry VIII, but that wasn't imagined for him, now aged only three. For now, the image of him in his first or second public appearance, causing a sensation by precociously riding a horse, is where we will begin. In an age where everything was political, this small procession revealed just how intense and unstable the regime of Henry VII actually was in its early days. That for all the grandeur of the House of Tudor, the foundations were very shaky indeed. And this procession kind of proves it. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of the city in chronological sequence, stopping along the way to take in some of the more interesting things we find. And we've reached the year 1493 and explore how over the next few years London was to witness how Henry VII responded to the grave threat to his realm. I'm pleased to welcome you now to chapter 179 of the story, back after a week's break for Christmas. Sorry, I genuinely thought I'd get last week's episode out, but it was Christmas Eve, so it took a week. Welcome then to the Spectre of Perkin Warbeck. To understand why Prince Henry was riding through the streets of the city, we need to understand his young life so far and what was going on around him. Without these two things, this procession makes no sense. But with this information, suddenly everything takes on a whole new dimension. Prince Henry was born on the 28th of June of 1491 at the Royal Palace of Bellacourt. Bellacourt had been the name given to the residence built out on the side of the old abbey down in Greenwich. All the way back in chapter 155, we had mentioned how this site had passed to Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, and he'd basically developed a very beautiful residence there, which had been used by that noble to be the base of his power east of London itself. Time had passed, and Bellacourt had been updated through the years and now stood as the Royal Palace in Greenwich. It dominated that part of the River Thames where the river opened up towards the estuary, and it was here, in this building, that Prince Henry had been born. King Henry was lucky. So far, all of his children had been born healthy. His eldest boy, Arthur, the Prince of Wales, was a strong, strapping lad. And then along had come a daughter, who he had named Margaret. And then in 1591, the third child, Henry. Tradition said the heir to the throne, the future King Arthur, was to be brought up in the world of his father, groomed from the moment he could comprehend, to inherit the title and the power and the dangers of being king. But that the spares, be they male or female, would be raised by the queen. Here, in that palace of Greenwich, now moved on from being called Bellacourt. Queen Elizabeth of York took her duty to her newborn spare seriously. Elizabeth had been in charge of making sure that the baptism of this prince, a spare one to be sure, but still a prince, was to be carried out with the correct solemnity. And it was indeed Queen Elizabeth who made sure that the politics remained on brand for the new House of Tudor for this child's first public appearance. Everything was to look regal, majestic, timeless. No reminders could exist that this dynasty was, you know, brand new. In all ways, this was to be the pageantry of the old, brought to life in a new way. No expense was spared for the baptismal ceremony. In the chapel nearby where it took place, tapestries swathed the walls and the floors. They built a tiered wooden stage for all to witness the baptism. Around that stage, they hung cloths of linen from Cyprus, gold, damask, fine and expensive materials. They imported a solid silver baptismal font all the way from Canterbury Cathedral. Witnessing the baptism were dignitaries and officials from the court and across the land. And before them all, the Lord Privy Seal himself, Richard Fox, officiating this religious ceremony because of his new role as Bishop of Exeter, performed the full ceremony, immersing the young baby three times into water. The baptismal oath given, baby Henry was wrapped in an ermine blanket trimmed with gold as trumpets blared and ceremonial torches were lit. For a first public appearance, it was a hell of a one. And after this grand ceremony, the baby Henry had been moved to the nearby manor house of Eltham. And over the next couple of years, he grew up there. And around him, the household grew. Here, Henry began to grow into his life with his elder sister Margaret, and he was then joined by two new sisters, Mary and Elizabeth. But Elizabeth didn't last for very long. Child mortality rates were high, even for healthy princesses. And the chances are Prince Henry's life would have remained in Eltham for at least the next few years, secluded and hidden away from the world. Except by the autumn of 1494, his father had a problem. And that problem was residing across the sea in Flanders. That problem called himself Richard the Duke of York, son of Edward IV and de jure, and by right, King Richard IV of England, Ireland and France. Correct heir to the throne and claimant and heir of the mighty legacy and dynasty of the Plantagenets. He claimed he was the youngest of the two princes in the tower who had gone missing during the reign of their uncle Richard III. He claimed he had not been killed but had survived and now, prince in exile, resided in Europe amidst his noble allies, preparing to reclaim his legacy and inherit by conquest the rights belonging to him as the true scion of the House of York. Of course, he was not that man. His real name was apparently Perkin Warbeck, an impostor, groomed from a young age to appear like Richard. And his entire campaign was a folly and a con, designed to give Henry VII's rivals in Europe a weapon to use against him. There are many at the time who greeted him as Prince Richard across Europe, who said he was indeed de jure king. Were they liars? Going along with the con to embarrass and diminish the King of England, were they fools taken in by this con? We cannot say with absolute certainty what was the answer. And even today, there are heterodox historians who insist that Perkin Warbeck was Richard Duke of York. The consensus at the time, however, and since, was that he was a strange young figure on the periphery of power and politics. And yet, in the end, it matters not one jot if he was Richard or not. It actually doesn't. What matters is simply, for whatever reason, did others take his claim seriously at the time? Politics is ultimately a zero-sum game. It's always a battle. What mattered to all was, did Perkin Warbeck have support that could translate itself into, say, cash, or into, say, men willing to fight for him. Did he have men willing to die for him and his cause? And the answer there is a resounding yes. There wasn't many who were willing to die for him, but there was some. This cause, as unlikely as it seems when you read the Tudor accounts of history, was very real. And in many ways, this says something the Tudors would have not liked us to have heard. Because if everything they said was true, even if we accept their account, and the majority political consensus of the era, and the historical consensus since, and say this really was a young boy called Perkin Warbeck, who somehow was taken seriously, and focus on scoffing at the incredulity or duplicity of those who believe such nonsense, we're doing this because the Tudors played a brilliant shell game. They want us to look at this and ignore the obvious truth sat right next to it. With the sleight of hand of a skilled illusionist, the Tudor King Henry VII and his sons and daughters and their sons and daughters need us to ignore the terrible truth staring everyone in the face right now. The fact that anyone at all took this claim seriously does not say anything about the believability of the claim of Warbeck. It screams to us of the fragility and still tentative hold on to power Henry VII actually had. One does not need to respond to fantastical and crazy claimants except with contempt and then obliteration. One does not need to set your entire government policy against it, not if it wasn't a threat. One does not need to press gang a small child, a young son of your family, into service unless you were desperate. And in truth, Henry VII was forced to do those things. He had already, as we covered last chapter, been forced to suspend all trade between England and Flanders, causing immeasurable damage to the fortunes of London, as he demanded the merchant adventurers forgo their profitable route of exporting the largest amount of the nation's commodities to their most profitable market. And he had done this because this was all he could do to show his displeasure towards Perkin Warbeck being given shelter in Flanders. This does not sound like the actions of a king with a firm grip on power. Quite the opposite. It sounds like a desperate play, a stratagem deployed when you had nothing else to use. It speaks of a king suddenly, genuinely undermined by this threat. And proof more comes a year later after that policy was initiated, when his actions had already caused riots on the streets of the capital, and where he could see he was generating anger and resentment in his most powerful city and could not change course. The king had Prince Henry brought to London to perform that ritual of riding through the streets. Why? Because of what would happen the day after he rode through London, astounding all with his ability to control his horse as it walked sedately through the crowd. You see, if you want proof that Henry VII was feeling the danger of Perkin Warbeck, you have to see why he insisted his son had to come all the way to Westminster. Henry needed to, not wanted to, but needed to counter the claim of Perkin Warbeck. If there was this young person over in Europe claiming to be the Duke of York, Henry VII needed a real Duke of York to counter this person. And he had no one he could use, unless in desperation and utter need, he placed his 3-year-old son into the title. And this is why we are treated to the spectacle of what happened the following day, on the 30th of October, 1494. There in Westminster Hall, King Henry performed what was in all respects a ridiculous ceremony. He knighted his son. He actually made a 3-year-old boy a knight there. And this is the Holy Feast of All Hallows Day, don't forget. And no sooner had he done this than he lifted up the infant and, quote, set him upon the table, unquote, proudly, in full view of the assembled court. And then he had him invested as the Duke of York. And this was the full ceremony. The boy was given all the formal symbols of the office. He had to wear the cap the sword, hold the rod, even have the bloody coronet put on his head. Afterwards, this toddler in very adult clothing was now brought to the adjoining chapel of St. Stephen's, where a celebratory and solemn mass was held in full, overseen by the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, along with 8 other bishops, and with the chapel royal choir singing in soaring voices glorious hymns of praise and adulation. And after this came the formal ritual procession in state. It was late now. The procession was illuminated by torchlight. People saw a riot of royal purple and crimson silk, of jewelled collars and cloths of gold. Henry VII strode before all, Lord Imperial, King, Majesty, and without equal in the land. But beside him, his young son was tired now and stumbled and actually had to be carried much of the way. This event is held up for its glory and not the ridiculousness of the situation. Henry wasn't doing this because he wanted to. King Henry was doing this because he had to. Everything in this age is political. Anything the king does has a political dimension to it. And so Henry, making his son the Duke of York, was now formally, for everybody else, a glorious thing, and it would be treason at the time to say otherwise. But if anything screams to us of the desperation of the early Tudor dynasty in their struggle to maintain power, it is this. The King of England forced to bring his toddler son into the heart of the full regalia and rituals of the ancient English state to counter the threat of a young boy no one has even seen, except a few members of foreign courts and isolated foreign towns, but whose ghost is forcing the king's hand. Now, it wasn't Warbeck himself that did this, it was a shade. The spectre of the House of York still haunted England. This ephemeral foe was overwhelming the new House of Tudor, and Henry VII is clearly being forced to take drastic measures. If everything is political, then this, what's going on now, is a show, and this show was important, as was what happened the following day. A celebratory joust was held. Londoners could engage in that most powerful of political weapons, the Tudor equivalent of bread and circuses, a formal joust. A fine spectacle to dazzle the eye and distract the attention. On the first day, those who took part in that joust all wore the green and white of the regime of Henry VII. But on the second day, they all wore the tawny brown and blue of the new Duke of York. All was for show and part of a political game that was trying to deal with an actual existential threat to the regime. And this was not all he was having to do. It's fair to say that right now, King Henry VII was fighting back. But while he had only 2 years before been able to launch an army to land at Calais and invade France, briefly, he could not maintain armies in the field of Europe for long. He could not attack Perkin Warbeck or attack his claim with physical force. But it does not mean he was unable to mount an offensive using other methods of warfare. Because he did. Because ultimately, King Henry VII was paranoid. I mean, he had reason to be paranoid, sure. But because of this, Henry VII, far more than any king before him, began utilising intelligence. And to illustrate this new aspect of English life he was tapping into, we need to examine the people who we know would become his spies and his watchers for him. Perhaps the most interesting of his spies in this era was a man called Roger Mercado. Mercado, in a few years' time, would retire to Southampton. But even then, he was described as a man, quote, late of London, unquote. And in truth, it's within our city that Roger Mercado had his career and his life. And by all accounts, he was a very successful spy. Only, let's just make one thing clear right now. There was no such thing as a spy in this era. Nobody existed to be employed to gather intelligence. That's a silly idea. What happened was that people were doing other jobs, and they would turn out to be people who could gather intelligence as they did their other jobs, and they'd be paid some additional money for giving that intelligence to the king. Every merchant sea captain, for example, was an intelligence gatherer. They could and were paid to report back on the things they saw when they arrived somewhere. Every merchant with operations in Europe was an intelligence gatherer and would report back what they saw. And a servant in a household could gain much intelligence about that household, and again, be paid to repeat back what they saw. This is the basic building block of the Tudors' much-feared intelligence-gathering networks. They were all built upon having the funds to purchase the secrets and loyalties of people in positions that allowed them access to secrets and information. And in this, Roger Mercado was ideally placed. Roger Mercado was actually born Roy Mercado, and was probably, by all accounts, Portuguese. We see him turning up as a herald, those brightly dressed people announcing stuff publicly. But already, when he first shows up, he's giving us signs that he has a double life. He's working under an assumed name. Back in the 1470s, he was called Leicester Harold. And we find him at royal events like the marriage of Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the future Richard III, and Anne Neville. And then we find him at the funeral of Edward IV. And this tells us that, one, he was moving in very high circles. And two, he was trusted with ceremonial work at a time where precedence and protocol were everything. Heralds weren't just fancy messengers. They were usually experts in genealogy, in understanding how noble rank worked. You know, who was allowed to sit where at a royal funeral without punching somebody? Mercado seemed to be doing just fine in this role, until something happened round about 1484. He fled England and returned up in Portugal. Now, did he leave because he had unpaid debts? He could have. Did he have a falling out with, say, Richard III? Also, he could have. But what we do know is that by 1485, Mercado was working for Thomas Grey, the Marquis of Dorset, who also happened to be Queen Elizabeth Woodville's son. And this is how he became a supporter of Henry Tudor. And certainly, he began to earn Henry Tudor's trust, because after the Battle of Bosworth, Henry rewarded Mercado handsomely, named him Richmond Harold, and soon after began sending him on diplomatic missions. And here's where things get really interesting. Mercado wasn't just delivering letters on behalf of the king. He was often carrying secret instructions from the king. He was talking to Charles VII of France about his suspicions about the Emperor Maximilian's support for Perkin Warbeck. He delivered delicate messages about potential marriage alliances, and he was gathering information that Henry could keep to use both against the Yorkist claimant and his foreign enemies in Europe. And we know all of this because Mercado actually apparently kept a journal, a rare treasure from this period. And in it, we get a glimpse of the tightrope walk he often had to make. One mission in particular, in 1494, had him telling Charles of France that Henry VII wasn't worried at all about Perkin Warbeck. Oh, what the Emperor Maximilian was up to. No, not at all. He is totally calm. Couldn't care less, mate. Which was a massive tell that he was, in fact, extremely worried. But it's the job of the diplomat spy to lie persuasively with a pleasant smile and impeccable manners. It's actually possible that Mercado was actually the original source of a little detail about Perkin Warbeck, that he had a funny eye or a lazy eye or a squint, and that be later used to question his actual royal authenticity. As a herald, Mercado wore these loud, outrageous robes that were covered in royal insignia. And let's be honest, he would have stood out like a peacock at a funeral. And that would seem to make him, ironically, the least discreet person to send on secret missions. But that's part of what made heralds such useful tools. Because they were so brightly adorned, they could travel across borders with official status. They could participate in the public ceremonies. And they could listen quietly while everyone assumed they were just there to shout announcements and wave flags. Meanwhile, they were gathering names, overhearing gossip, and bringing it all back to the king. It helped that he could speak 5 languages. His career was long, and it's filled with lots of odd little gaps that suggest a lot of secret work. He will eventually retire to Southampton, and his long career will reward him with a household filled with luxuries everywhere. Here was a man who made a lot of money from being Henry VII's main international spy and clandestine diplomat. But while this man was very much a poster child for Henry VII's fledgling spy network, literally an international man of mystery and myriad name who made a fortune from his efforts, the bulk of what Henry was using for his intelligence network was far more grounded and down to earth, bound across his own realm. Servants, staff, people overlooked. A veritable legion of informants for his fledgling secret police network. And it was via this that he stumbled across the horrifying revelation that Warbeck's spectre haunted even the highest levels of his society, that it reached as deep as the royal household itself. King Henry VII discovered two traitors working at the very heart of his regime. His two most powerful household officials, the head of the servants, his below stairs chief, the Lord Steward, Lord Fitzwater. And most disturbingly at all, his Lord Chamberlain, the man who controlled access to the chamber, the public and private apartments, Sir William Stanley, brother to Lady Margaret Beaufort's husband, Lord Stanley. Remember, Sir William Stanley and his men had actually turned the tide for Henry at the Battle of Bosworth. He is that important to the regime. But even though his move at the Battle of Bosworth had allowed Henry to take the throne, he was a former loyalist of Edward IV, and for him and for so many others, there were questions of allegiance that mingled and clashed with questions of self-interest. And despite the recognition he'd received under King Henry for all the work he'd done for him, Sir William had never felt entirely settled in his new position. Meanwhile, Henry was all too aware of the Stanley's history of changing sides, and even though they had helped at the Battle of Bosworth, they did arrive at that battle, you know, late. Which, oddly enough, they'd done as well at the smaller and much overlooked Battle of Stoke. Still, Sir William was arrested and brought before the king in the first days of 1495. And Henry's display of absolute wounded astonishment probably masked the fact that they both knew he'd been watching the Stanley's retinues for well over a year. Stanley was tried and beheaded, a proof that the spectre of Warbeck was much more powerful than Warbeck himself. As the Stanley plot was unfolding, the royal household became much more rigorously controlled. Officials carrying lists of servants carried out identity checks. At night, heavily armed beefeaters, the yeomen of the guard, paced the household's galleries and chambers with extra vigilance and extra numbers. The king became more distant, more remote. People around him became increasingly afraid to talk openly, looking over their shoulders, lowering their voices. Henry was trapped by circumstances. The massive disruption of trade he had ordered was very unpopular, and coupled with his rather high tax demands, this resulted in there being actual serious opposition to the king's policies right now, and the Stanley's conspiracy came in the midst of this. Henry's relationship with his leading subjects began to change. And meanwhile, Perkin Warbeck is trying to extend the threads of his web of influence by writing to Queen Isabella of Spain to invite her to support him. And we know in November 1493, Perkin Warbeck was actually escorted by Albert, the Duke of Saxony, to Vienna to attend the funeral of the Emperor Frederick III. And there he met Maximilian, who received him as the rightful King of England. By the summer of 1494, Maximilian was back in the Low Countries with Warbeck, who now sported a white rose and the arms of Richard, Prince of Wales. This young man was causing a bevy of diplomatic action, which is why you had the English Herald spy telling the French king that he doesn't worry about Perkin Warbeck. He treats the matter, quote, le garant, unquote, lightly. There's nothing to worry about at all. But there was a lot going on behind the scenes. Henry could at least say he treated the matter lightly, because he didn't think that Maximilian would ever have the funds or resources to actually stage a large-scale incursion from the Netherlands. but he wasn't treating the plot lightheartedly on the home front. And if you want further proof of just how big the Perkin-Warbeck thing was on the home front, it is worth saying that Perkin-Warbeck's career as a royal pretender really began in Ireland, in Cork. He turned up there in 1491 and then he'd left. And that had forced the king to send a military force to Ireland in 1491. And this led to other things. And we need to talk about Ireland right now. Because what was going on in Ireland was to play a huge role in England's and London's politics down the road in a few years. So excuse me while we take a slight diversion, but this does tie in not just to what's going to come, but what's happening now with Perkin-Warbeck. As we covered only three chapters ago, it was here in Ireland that a 10-year-old son of an Oxford joiner, Lambert Simnel, was crowned King Edward VI in Christchurch in Dublin on May 1487, supported by many Irish lords, leading to the failed campaign that ended in the Battle of Stoke. So why the hell had Ireland become this bastion of opposition to Henry VII? Well, things in Ireland were complicated. And the reason they were complicated actually goes back to the reign of Henry VI. During his reign, you see, the king's lieutenant in Ireland was Richard the Duke of York. Yes, we're back into the War of the Roses. And during the early part of the War of the Roses, he not only could use Ireland as a launchpad of his own political ambitions, by June 1460, he had won almost all of Ireland to the cause of the White Rose. And even more than London, Ireland became the Yorkist region of the kingdom. How the hell had he done that? Well, partly it was his heritage. When he was appointed the lieutenant of the place in 1447, the Duke of York had inherited already several Irish titles. He was the Earl of March, the Earl of Ulster, the Lord of Tim, and the Lord of Connaught. Even the native Irish nobility saw him as, well, you know, partly one of them. And the Anglo-Irish nobility were eager to have him in this post. And when he did arrive in Ireland on the 6th of July, 1449, with the black dragon standard of Ulster carried before him, his personal appeal was widely felt amongst most of the Irish lords. Many of them flocked to make submission and pay respects to him. What he did to gain their loyalty above and beyond that was to promote the idea that, you know, the Irish should be in charge of themselves. And the Duke of York really lent in to the support doing this gave him. He was the king's lieutenant, the overlord of Ireland. But then he appointed Thomas Fitzgerald, the 7th Earl of Kildare, as his deputy lieutenant. And if he had it so he wasn't around, Fitzgerald was the virtual ruler of Ireland. This policy paid dividends for him. When York was driven in exile during the War of the Roses in 1459, he returned to Ireland, summoned a parliament in Drogheda in February 1460, and the Irish lords threw their full-body support behind him as he declared in forthright terms the legislative and legal independence of Ireland from that English state ruled by Henry VI. This idea had legs. But it is worth reminding everybody that Richard, Duke of York, never gained the throne of England. His son, Edward IV, did. And this meant that his Irish inheritance passed to him, and it merged now with the royal estates. Edward IV had to, you know, re-establish his rule over Ireland, which led to moments like the execution of the Earl of Desmond, and he did antagonise several lords, but he made sure that dominance in Ireland soon passed for many years back to Thomas Fitzgerald, the 7th Earl of Kildare. And then from 1478, there's a few gaps, to his son and heir, Gerald Fitzgerald, the 8th Earl of Kildare. Gerald effectively became the real power of Ireland. And behind him, almost all the Anglo-Irish nobility, with the exception of one family called the Butlers, threw their weight behind him, and he actually had a massive sway over the native Irish nobility that played beyond the reach of any Anglo-Irish lord before him. Richard III's short reign didn't change anything in Ireland, and the Kildares continued to rule as deputies, no matter who was working as a king's lieutenant in absentia. But then the Yorkist dynasty fell after the Battle of Bosworth, and hey presto, the Irish nobility now had a choice. Throw in with this new Tudor dynasty and see what would do to their nominal independence, or hold on to the Yorkist pretensions and defy the Tudor, if possible, to the point of overthrowing him. And so the Irish lords had picked the second option, and that was why when Lambert Simnel appeared in Dublin, suitably trained beforehand, the Irish lords had no difficulty in deciding that he was actually the Earl of Warwick, the very son of George, Duke of Clarence, who'd actually been born in Dublin. And they could sense that if this is actually his son, sure, he's one of us. He's an Irish prince. Hence, Limbert Samnel found himself crowned with a circuit of gold that had been stolen from a nearby statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary and proclaimed King Edward. The attempt to put him on the throne had seen a battle, wherein the mainstay of the opposition forces had been German mercenaries and Irish loyal to the cause. But while they had been beaten, Henry VII now had to deal with Ireland. In May 1488, he'd sent over Sir Richard Edgecombe, a councillor and controller of his household, to make peace with the Irish lords. While this swore allegiance to Henry, their loyalty was not secure. 6 years were to elapse before a more formidable visitation was to arrive in Ireland from the king, in the persona of Sir Edward Poynings. Poynings had turned up in Ireland and instantly sought to march on Ulster to curtail the nobles up there who'd been causing various troubles, mostly to do with Perkin Warbeck. But he discovered on his way there that there was an attempt to be mounted on his life by the Earl of Kildare, and so he turned around and summoned a parliament to Drogheda in late 1494 to deal with it. He had them pass an act of attainder against the Earl of Kildare. But he also passed what became known over the coming centuries as Poynings' Laws, or the Statutes of Drogheda, which were basically a new clarification for the Irish, which changed everything over there. In effect, no parliament could now be held in Ireland without the direct and explicit say-so of the Privy Council in England. And secondly, any act by the English Parliament automatically now applied to Ireland. Whereas English involvement in Ireland had to this date been fraught, problematic and most often violent, and whereas many, especially the Irish, could argue that the Anglo-Irish nobility who had taken over the region of the East Coast under English control, the Pale, was an occupation, it was at this moment that everything changed. Henceforth, Ireland was subject to English laws and had no voice of its own. At a stroke, Henry VII had changed Ireland's relationship with England and began now a chain of events that was to see his dynasty and more the entire nation become more and more involved in Irish affairs as the years went by. And the irony of all that is that it started now. The legacy of the War of the Roses on Pot Ireland is often overlooked. The Yorkist desire to coat Ireland with promises of freedom had made them inclined to support Perkin Warbeck, and as such faced the paranoid Henry VII and his hatchetman Poynings, who in response to this did the only thing they could do, which was to drag Ireland closer to him in order to prevent it becoming a bastion of danger to his regime. Again, proving for me how much danger Henry VII perceived in the Warbeck incident. And as much as I could go on into even more extraordinary detail about the entire Perkin Warbeck episode, we have to return our gaze to London, and at this point we will end this summary by saying that Warbeck was receiving funds from his foreign supporters, but he was making no headway. In 1495, Margaret of Burgundy funded Perkin Warbeck to launch an invasion and rebellion of England, and he landed in Kent with a small force. But before he even stepped off his ship, he found he had no popular support whatsoever, and he watched as about 150 of his small force of troops killed in fighting and was forced to flee from the port of Deal. Warbeck then travelled to Ireland and did gain the support of the 9th Earl of Desmond and some armed men and attempted to take the town of Waterford, but this failed. Then he had to flee and he ended up in Scotland. Here, young King James IV of Scotland was no friend of Henry VII and not only welcomed Warbeck, but arranged for him to marry his own kinswoman, Catherine, the daughter of the Earl of Huntly. Their marriage was celebrated in some style, with feasting and a tournament. King James now had excuse to invade England in support of Warbeck under the title of King Richard IV, saying he was England's rightful monarch, and in the autumn of 1496, Warbeck and the Scottish army crossed the Tweed, But that campaign was a mess, and at the first sign of English opposition, they retreated. So while King Henry VII was a good decade into his reign, his regime has been haunted by the spectre of this young man. And what was going on in London? Well, as we covered last chapter, London was at odds with the king, but not about Perkin Warbeck. That idiot's campaign had caused the king to place an embargo on trade from London to the Low Countries. And this had caused tensions in the city. Not that anyone could protest the king's decisions, no, that would be treason. But as we saw last chapter, German merchants who made money exploiting the fact they could trade, oh, they'd seen violence and that riot we covered last chapter. So what happened next? Well, on the 4th of April, 1494, King Henry had ordered that all English cloth currently stuck in storage in London should be shipped to Calais, unless a special license had been obtained from him by cash. This did two things. One, it prevented London-based merchants from smuggling out their cloth for trade, but it also sent a message to the merchants adventurers of London that they had annoyed the king with their constant pressure for the embargo to be lifted. Moving the cloth to Calais really did add insult to injury for the adventurers. Don't forget there's a running political battle between the merchant adventurers and the wool staplers, and that had not grown any less. Moving goods to Calais was a sort of victory for the staplers, but it also seems to have gained support generally in the city as a whole, because all the merchants were now desperate to at least move their goods. And as we mentioned last chapter, a counter-embargo had been duly imposed by the Emperor Maximilian. Yes, there was smuggling, and yes, many merchants tried to circumnavigate these new rules, but in truth, merchants on both sides of the channel were now suffering heavily. Negotiations about this issue had to start. There was simply too much money involved. And starting in December 1495, they began. Ambassadors from the Netherlands turned up in London, and they were meeting a delegation of 12 merchant adventurers, including the past Governor Pickering, and they were led by a member of the Mercers' Company of London, Richard Fox, who was being Henry VII's chief negotiator. What came from it was a treaty signed in February 1496, a so-called Intercursus Magnus. This allowed all merchants of both countries free access to one another and trade to and in the territories of Henry, Maximilian, and Archduke Philip in all commodities. I mean, English cloth suffered a couple of extra regulations. English merchants could only sell it wholesale. But beyond that, all tolls were to be charged at the levels usual over the last 50 years. Henry VII described it as a, quote, firm league and plain intercourse of merchandises as free as has been used in any time past, unquote. And it did bring the new Tudor king at least in line with his predecessors over the last 50 years. However, it did require that towns involved in this had to pay a lot of cash up front in the form of bonds in order to be able to join in this new treaty. And the Common Council of London simply refused to pay it. Rather than have a huge debate about it, the mayor, Henry Collett, covered the bond with his own personal money. And trade was back on the menu. And yet, all London's merchants were well aware that this 1496 intercursus really just re-established the trade conditions agreed all the way back in 1446. What was new in it was mostly stuff that bothered Henry VII alone, the many clauses relating to promises of the several rulers not supporting rebels and enemies of each other. See, that was Henry VII's main political issue. The real reason for making this treaty was not commerce, but his fear that the likes of Perkin Warbeck could find safe haven in the Low Countries. Henry VII actually had no coherent policy towards merchanting and commercial trade, and his policies just endlessly damaged what trade did exist. And even with this treaty, London's merchants saw issues around them increase, which were all political. Henry VII was all focused on stability, but Archduke Philip the Fair was all focused on rebuilding his monies after losing so much in endless civil wars over the last few years. Within a few months of the new treaty, Archduke Philip imposed a new toll on all cloth from England, Scotland and Ireland, known as the Andrew Guilder. And in April 1496, Henry VII wrote a letter to the English merchants saying they should not pay it. Right now, the fraught nature of trade between London and Flanders required tact, it required artful diplomacy, it required genuine political skill. What they got was Henry VII, who was being paranoid and mostly used to just acting first and thinking second. He made the former governor of the Merchant Adventurers, John Pickering, the governor of them again. On paper, this was a sound idea, as the London merchants who were operating in Flanders needed the man in charge of them in Flanders, the governor, to be a man who was highly skilled and well-versed in the task. And Pickering certainly was that. The issue was the king never appointed who was the governor of the Merchant Adventurers in Flanders. The Merchant Adventurers did. And this appointment, as prudent as it was, did put out a lot of noses at the time. Luckily for everybody, Pickering represented a large rump of London merchants who just wanted to sell their bloody goods. So they ignored the grumbles from other members and started acting at once. Pickering intended to go abroad immediately and set up the old conditions of trade after this ban, and he carried with him a letter from the wardens of the Mercers' Company to those merchants adventurers already in Bruges and Bergen. He had in tow his nephew and close associate, Roger Thorney, and they were allowed generous expenses to start the ball rolling. With cloth piled high in warehouses after this long ban, the London adventurers were desperate to go to Antwerp, and that city was also desperate to have them turn up. And now the sailing of the cloth fleet was timed to arrive at the next Whitsunmarkt, the most valuable of all the fairs. However, let's just throw a spanner in the works. For various reasons, King Henry wanted them to go to Bergen, not Antwerp. In the end, it was agreed that the official cloth ship should go to Bergen, apparently ignoring the dates of any fair, and any man who decided to ship to Antwerp was going to be heavily fined. Somehow, despite this, London managed to ship over 18,000 bolts of cloth from London in the year following Michaelmas 1496. But troubles and confusions proliferated at all corners, and the governor was seriously overworked and found he was needed in at least two places at once several times. English merchants and their goods were arrested and impounded, not only for not paying the Andrew Gilder as had been told, but also for not paying these new heavy tolls that suddenly emerged as they just turned up. Governor Pickering was amongst those arrested for refusing to pay these brand new, made-up-on-the-spot tolls, and he responded by starting a significant lawsuit before the Council of Brabant. And that prevented him from being present when the main London cloth fleet reached the waters of Zeeland on its way to Bergen. The fleet ran into local tollkeepers, who basically said, pay these excessive new tolls we're doing, or we're going to forfeit your goods. The situation was a mess, and as news filtered back of the mess, Henry VII was sending them snarky letters, demanding why some of them kept paying local taxes after he told them not to. Gee, thanks, Henry. And then he told them to return to England with as little damage to themselves as they could manage, quote, in secret and covert-wise, unquote. Pickering was able to do some good. In July 1496, he got the town of Middleburg to reduce their tolls to the normal levels, but trade could barely function in this mess. The new Flemish tax on cloth remained a problem, and the adventurers began to organise their secret departure from the region. Thus, it was scarcely 6 months after the intercursus, in September 1496, that Henry VII ordered all English cloth merchants once again to start operating out of Calais. This meant that the merchant adventurers had to then ask him for royal letters to protect them against the bloody wool staplers' bloody regulations and their tolls, and also other letters to ensure that every other merchant in England, not just the London ones, were forced to go to Calais as well. And these letters were forthcoming, but the adventurers were to be stuck in Calais for the best part of a year. An endless round of deputations to the king annoying him were then to follow. In January 1497, Pickering was busy explaining to one of Henry VII's French secretaries in Bruges about the injuries inflicted by the Duke cloth tax and several water tolls. The Mercers' Company of London was battling back at home with their new clerk having to be the go-between, between the adventurers of London and the Chancellor of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was a time of confusion, trade being crippled by politics and tariffs and tolls, and there was Henry VII trying desperately to focus on this Perkin-Warbeck issue, and why is everyone from London bothering him about the small, boring details of trade technicalities, for God's sake? And yet, around it, London just continued. I mean, in 1496, we start seeing bricks start becoming much more common in the buildings of, well, important buildings, such as Shane Palace in Richmond or Crosby Place. In 1496, we actually read that Westminster Abbey was contracted to make a staggering number of 400,000 bricks upon its estate in Hampstead. It's possible they were intended to help rebuild Westminster itself, although no building work of that period is known to have demanded such a sheer number of bricks. More likely, they were intended for the construction of the first bell-sized house in Hampstead, a large mansion that was to certainly exist by 1550. And at the same time, we see the first mention of a group in London called the Doctors' Commons. Their proper title was the College of Advocates and Doctors of Law. This was a group made up of those who practiced law in the ecclesiastical and admiralty courts, a body of specialist lawyers separate from ordinary barristers, and they were to remain in existence until the mid-19th century. Their headquarters ended up being in Paternoster Road, but by 1570 they were based off Knight Rider Street near St. Paul's Churchyard. And as you can see, the city is doing fine, hoping things could just calm down a little with the trade. Yeah. And then, suddenly, a massive army of tens of thousands of rebellious Cornishmen turned up, intending to burn the city to the ground. Wait. What? What? Yeah. The story continues next week as we try to explain how, apparently out of nowhere, and with seriously no warning at all, and with no link to what seems to be anything else going on, a massive army of Cornishmen really did suddenly arrive in South London and were fully intending to storm the entire city. And there was a battle, and yeah, that needs its own episode, I think. So I'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. As I said, had a break over Christmas. We're now back again. Weekly episodes starting now. My name's Saul. I hope you're all warm, safe, well, and good, and have a really good new year. See you next week. Bye.